Yeah, there you go.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to our final session with Dr. Suzanne Free on Simon Wiesenthal's book, The Sunflower. It's been a wonderful series. She has fresh sunflowers today, sunflower seeds, and Lois Franks brought sunflower cookies. So
In
I
good
think
shape.
it just shows that we've all enjoyed this very, very much. And I want you to know that next week's also going to be good. I mean, really different. It's called Those Revolting Presbyterians. What were they thinking? And our own Bill Ludwig, Clerk of Session at Westminster, is going to spark our curiosity about what was going on with religion and the founding fathers. And so this is one not to miss. And Bill is with us today. So if you have any questions about it, you can ask him. You can also read about it in the bulletin and on the website. And now Sue will open with prayer.
Let us pray, folks. Eternal God, we thank you for the freedom to read and ponder the sunflower. In this chapel, safe from persecution, help us to remember the struggles of millions of good people whose lives ended in catastrophe. In our time, our human nature remains conflicted. We are disciples of Christ, but fail to see him in each other and in every human being on earth. Inspire us to denounce inhumanity wherever we find it. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, good morning. Good to see you. If anybody by any chance still wants a syllabus for reading over the summer, I have a few. Also, this is kind of a collage of some of the most important lines that we've been talking about. We probably won't have time today to get to this one, but I have copies of it with a little bit of commentary. That is a poem that is carved into the entrance of a concentration camp, Belzec, I think, by Dan Pages, and it's written from the point of view of Eve. And let me just read it to you. It's not that I covered up any more of the poem, it just ends in mid-sentence. Here in this carload, I am Eve with Abel, my son. If you see my other son, Cain, son of man, tell him I. And that's where it ends. Imagine perhaps the door on the freight car, the cattle car, suddenly being pushed open, and who knows what happens after that. It's a beautiful poem. All right, last week, we ran through a summary of eight essays at breakneck speed, but by comparing essay to essay to essay, it gradually becomes apparent that forgiveness of a great evil is complicated. You remember what the Dalai Lama said? Yes, forgive the officer. Always forgive. Forgive even atrocities with no conditions. We didn't have time last week for Cynthia Ozick, who is his polar opposite. She says no, screaming it. And I want to make time for her today because I think we need her voice. As a member of the Academy of Arts and Letters, the American Academy, Ozick has won numerous prizes and awards for her novels and short stories. I've used one of her short stories on the Holocaust called The Shawl. And it has always left my students in stunned silence. If you can find it online, Google The Shawl by Cynthia Ozick. Her essay is the longest response to Wiesenthal, at least that we have read. It is not a short, unified, simple essay. It's written in four parts. Part one is called Uses of Jesus. She writes, "Should not a Christian education make it impossible for a child to grow up to be an SS man? Ruling out mental illness, should not a sentence like, 'The SS man grew up in a loving Christian family,' be such a contradiction in terms that the words come out as jabberwocky? How and why did Karl trade a pope for a Führer? the New Testament for Mein Kampf. Part two is called The Sources of Pity. Ozick nominates the Second Commandment as the biblical source of pity because it forbids the worship of idols like Moloch and Baal that required continuous sacrifices of human flesh to be appeased. The older story of Abraham and Isaac might also come to mind. God intervenes when Abraham raises the knife. Lay not your hands upon the boy. This God desires mercy and not sacrifice. But when sacrifice is required, he will provide the lamb. What a breakthrough in human understanding of the divine will. So, why didn't the Church of Martin Luther in Germany identify Hitler as the Moloch of his time? Pastor Niemöller's famous quote, "First they came for the socialists and I did not speak out," and it goes through all of the others and ends with, "And finally they came for me and there was nobody left to speak out." This relates to Ozick's question. If you shovel Jews into the idol's mouth today, do you think it will stop there? Why was the church in Germany so deafeningly silent? At one point, even reassuring American Christians, the German policy would permit only humane extermination. It wasn't fear of reprisal that muzzled the church. It was in large part tacit approval. The German church's own anti-Semitism went all the way back to Martin Luther and further back than that. In the 1930s, when free speech was still a reality in Germany, there were no protests against the violent anti-Semitism of the National Socialists. Where were the Lutherans? Since then, we have had apologies in great number, but too late. Part three is called Vengeance and Forgiveness. Here she makes a very powerful assertion that forgiveness can be pitiless. Why? Because it forgets the victims. Murder is irrevocable, she writes. Forgiving the murderers might even serve the Nazis' cause. Our desire for justice and punishment is not a bad thing. She says, our longing for justice is fired by the furnaces of our love and pity for the innocent dead. Simon shows pity when he holds Carl's hand and swats a fly away that keeps buzzing around his head. But where is Carl's pity for Simon? Do we hear him say to the nurse, bring this man some clean clothes, he's crawling with lice? He didn't have to be able to see to know that that would be the case. The face of forgiveness may look sweet and mild to us 75 years later, but Ozick says, how cold must it look to the dead? Part four is called Moral Tenderness, Moral Responsibility. Here she speaks in Carl's defense. She concedes that he is intelligently contrite. He is or has become a man of some conscience. Should not some special recognition be given to the change in him? We know what the Buddhists would say. What would you say? Why does Ozick say no? She explains, it is not that Carl lacked humanity when he put on the SS uniform. It's that he deadened it in himself for personal gain. Like Macbeth and Faust, he didn't lack conscience. He simply silenced it when the temptation to rise in the world became too powerful to resist. Carl never resisted. He shoveled babies into Moloch's mouth as long as it was to his advantage to do so. What stopped him was not revelation, but a grenade. The last page of Ozick's essay has smoke rising from it. We cannot make a Lazarus out of the Holocaust, she says. Carl is suffering the hell he has chosen for himself. Total separation from God's will. No wonder he is in agony If you've read Dante's Divine Comedy, you may remember what's written over the gates of hell. Abandon hope, all ye who enter here. John Ciardi noted in his commentary on Dante that the gates of hell are locked from the inside. C.S. Lewis made note of that in his book, The Great Divorce. The spirit there is something like Satan's in Paradise Lost. Better to reign in hell than serve in heaven. Ozick's last line is devastating. Better the fly go to God than he. So Ozick says no. By participating in genocide for personal gain, Carl forfeited forever his right to die in peace. As Eva Fleischner said, Carl's only hope was to throw himself on the mercy of God. And now we have a lot more views to consider, 8 or 9 today, as time permits, and we'll still have only looked at 16 or 17 out of 53. So much more to think about. But as we keep reading, it gradually becomes apparent that philosophers, science, psychiatrists, historians, artists, people of all faiths need each other to help sort this out, just as we need each other here. Before we dive into the next essays, and I promise they will be shorter than they were last week, I want to address two questions that usually come up once people have gotten into this book and finished it. After the war ended, what motivated Wiesenthal to visit Carl's mother? Was it just curiosity? What did he expect to find? What did he mean to say or do? Was he right to spare her of the facts of the kind of man her son became? Andre Stein addresses this in his essay. It starts on page 250. He says, I am not at peace with Simon's decision to let Carl's mother believe in her son's immaculate goodness. Simon had a responsibility toward past and future victims to tell her the truth. And Carl's mother had the responsibility of rising above her personal pain and telling the world what her good Christian son had become. She could have warned parents about the need to convince their children to opt against evil, no matter how good it looks in uniform. We must not forget the millions that millions were murdered by a nation of good sons. The voice of an honestly repentant mother of an SS murderer would have great credibility. By keeping the truth undercover, Simon enabled Carl's mother to live a nasty lie. As a child survivor of the Holocaust who lost 62 relatives to nice boys who wouldn't hurt a fly, I feel indignant about Carl's second decision to keep silent. And yet, the first time I read it, I felt how kind and good of him that he was that gentle with that old woman. A second question that is frequently asked, why were there no organized rebellions by the Jews? They certainly outnumbered their captives by the thousands. In fact, there were over 100 at Auschwitz, at Treblinka, in the Warsaw Ghetto, and other ghettos. Astonishing acts of resistance, despite starvation, mental and physical exhaustion, rampant disease, no access to weapons, and nowhere to run when and if they managed to escape. The Nazis made sure that the woods around the camps were full of wolves. Son of Saul, the Academy Award-winning film we talked about 2 weeks ago, is about the Auschwitz uprising in 1944, when prisoners managed to blow up one of 4 huge crematoriums and break through the electrified barbed wire fence. But such actions were superhumanly difficult. It took the planners a year to amass enough smuggled dynamite from a nearby munitions factory to make two small bombs, and one of them malfunctioned. For Classrooms Without Borders, I wrote a study guide for a book called Sala's Gift. In contrast to the passive withdrawal from reality of Carl's mother, this book tells the story of a woman named Alla Gertner, who, after being deported to Auschwitz and assigned to forced labor in an armaments factory, took her fate into her own hands. She was the leader of four courageous women who smuggled dynamite to the men at Auschwitz, quarter teaspoonfuls at a time, under their fingernails, in their hair, or wrapped in bits of cloth. The story of that uprising could take up a whole class in itself or a whole course. The courage of it and the futility of it stay with you. The prisoners who escaped after the explosion were recaptured and killed. The four women, Alla, Rosa, Regina, and Esther, were tortured and hanged publicly on January 5th, 1945, 22 days before the camp was liberated. The SS knew all was lost, and they still kept killing. The story of the heroic rebellion in the Warsaw ghetto in 1943 will astonish you. Using weapons supplied by children who smuggled them in through narrow tunnels under the cemetery that abutted the camp, they held off the Nazis for 27 days and scared the hell out of them. Warsaw was emptied and shut down. That is the ghetto. Okay, no more digressions. For the next 15 minutes, I will briefly summarize essays highlighted for today, focusing on what's new in each essay. Then we'll go to questions, votes, comments. First is Terence Pretty, author and consultant on the Middle East for the BBC. He agrees that the problem of forgiveness for Carl is of immense complexity. Carl is facing death, but he fails to consider that so is Simon, and has been facing it virtually every day since he arrived in the camp and before. Prisoners were often tortured or shot simply for the amusement of the bored SS, or because someone else tried to make an escape. He tried to escape, we're gonna shoot all you people. Pretty agrees with Eva Fleischner that Carl should not be asking forgiveness of man, only God. And he praises Wiesenthal, and this is somewhat new, for showing amazing restraint in not inflicting his fury and disgust on Carl, if only in words. Second is Matthew Ricard. He is a translator for the Dalai Lama, a Buddhist with a PhD in molecular biology. As you would expect, he says, forgive, with or without repentance. But he offers an additional explanation of the Buddhist point of view that helps us understand this. Of course, there has to be atonement, he says. Justice is not a negligible concept in Buddhism. Carl must make restitution for his sins. But how, when, and where? He must be born again, not in the sense of a Christian being born again, but literally leaving the world and re-entering it over and over and over. Buddhists solve the problem of injustice with their belief in karma and reincarnation. Carl is at the rock bottom of the spiritual chain of being, Ricard says. A depraved destroyer with no time to transform himself into something higher. So he must come back to earth, to the scene of his crimes, until he has done more good for his fellow man than he has done evil. That may take long. Only then can he find the peace he is seeking. Only then can he forgive himself, a necessary step to redemption. Forgiving Carl now is simply the Buddhist way of starting him on this long, steep road toward regeneration. Three, Joshua Rubinstein is a regional director of Amnesty International and professor of Russian history at Harvard. I think he's still there teaching. In his book, The Last Days of Stalin, he discusses Stalin's vicious anti-Semitism during and after the war, and he gives us new reasons to thank God for Stalin's sudden collapse and death in 1953. But for our purposes, he makes the new point that very few Nazis made any voluntary, heartfelt confessions, as Carl does. Not even at the Nuremberg trials, where it might have won them a more merciful judgment. But there's a reason so few of those Nazis expressed no remorse. During the war, those young SS or Gestapo or order police battalion men who began to have scruples, who realized they couldn't hack murdering people all day, were allowed to quit without punishment. Carl could have quit. They could request transfer to some other duty, and about 10 to 15% of them did so. Himmler acknowledged that it was hard to murder 1,000 people in a day and remain a moral human being. The trick, Himmler said, was learning how to function as a mass murderer for the fatherland, keeping that in its own mental compartment, but still maintaining the conscience of a normal, decent human being when you go home at night to your wife and children. At least Carl voluntarily repented, somewhat. But Rubinstein reminds us that no one forced him to join the Hitler Youth. He did so over the objections of his parents. No one forced him to join the SS. His father despised them. And here's the key. Other Germans with similar backgrounds and under the same social pressure joined the White Rose, a clandestine anti-Nazi group, or they resisted military service, or they worked to undermine the Reich by distributing leaflets in cities, or sending out secret information by radio. The ruthless Reinhard Heydrich, the architect of the Final Solution, known as the Blonde Beast by his peers, took for granted the blind loyalty of his grown son, Franz. He had no idea that Franz was forging passports to help German Jews escape right under his father's nose. No accounting for human nature. For every young man, for every German citizen, there was a choice, says Rubinstein. There is always a choice. As American poet Robinson Jeffers wrote in his poem, Shine, Perishing Republic, corruption has never been compulsory. Rubinstein ends his essay on a simple note. For Simon to forgive Carl would have been to betray his family, his religion, and all the prisoners waiting for him back at the camp. He is amazed that Simon didn't smother Carl with a pillow right then and there. 5, Sidney Shapnow. Here we get the voice of a career military man, a Lithuanian who escaped from a Nazi camp in 1944, became a US citizen, served as a Green Beret in Vietnam, and retired as a major general with many decorations for valor in combat. He says that all soldiers are trained to override their natural aversion toward taking human life. Carl was conditioned to follow orders and commit atrocities against the enemy. That's business as usual in the hell of modern warfare. However, Shapnow adds that the kind of misery he inflicted on innocent people, not enemy soldiers, but an entire race of people whose only sin was being born, defies his right to claim any extenuating circumstances whatsoever. He gave up his humanity to Hitler. He accepted completely that he was a superior being with the right to torture and execute all the non-Aryan scum of the earth, which included Jews, communists, homosexuals, Roma, Catholics, trade unionists, socialists, Poles, Slovaks, the mentally ill, the physically handicapped, and anyone who hid, spoke up for, or tried to protect these people. Hopefully that would be us. You've heard, I'm sure, the "I was only following orders" excuse. Shaq, now a career military man, discounts it altogether here. He refers to Carl as a savage, a blunt instrument for the Führer, who only at death's door pleads for readmission into the human race. Shaq now doubts that even God could grant him forgiveness. After all, he concludes, what does it take to serve in hell? Albert Speer, writer of Inside the Third Reich. Have any of you read this book? I know you have, two of you, okay. Speer was among the highest ranking Nazis, Hitler's chief architect of the Third Reich and his minister of armaments and munitions from 1942 to 45. But more impressive to us is that Speer is known as the one Nazi who said, sorry. At the Nuremberg trials, he was the only one to take moral responsibility for his complicity in Nazi war crimes. Though at the trials, he claimed he was ignorant of what was going on in the death camps, he would say that he did not know any specifics of the Holocaust because he did not want to know them. He did observe the vast number of Jews that were disappearing. After Nuremberg, he was shunned and despised by other convicted Nazis for his public repentance. He spent 20 years in Spandau prison, mostly reading and writing. The Sunflower came across his prison desk, and the essay he wrote in response is the polar opposite of Carl's confession. He has no hope of dying in peace. My moral guilt is not subject to the statute of limitations, he says. It cannot be erased in my lifetime. The Dalai Lama's Buddhist translator would agree with that. Speer will need many lifetimes to balance his karma. Speer acknowledges that Jewish and/or Christian forgiveness is out of the question. In his essay, he simply thanks Wiesenthal for showing pity to Carl and for making the difficult trip to Stuttgart to see his mother. Wiesenthal came to see Speer in prison, and Speer appreciated the irony of that. Simon, the despised subhuman Jew, was teaching Albert, the superior German Superman, what true superiority is in a human being. Kindness, sympathy for others' suffering, tolerance of difference, respect of difference, and rejection of hatred and vengefulness. Far more than church-raised Carl and Albert, Simon actually practiced loving his enemies. Speer said he felt touched by the grace of God through Simon's book and visit. The two became friends in later years. Among the many things they discussed was the importance of memory. Who gets to decide what is remembered and what is forgotten in World War II? And this is another book recommendation for you, which will eventually go into the library. I still have to use it for a few things. The Texture of Memory, James E. Young. This is fascinating in its discussion of all of the monuments and the memorials that exist around the world for the lost, to help people keep it in mind always and not push it to the back of the mind because you just can't stand to think about it. Most of these memorials are extraordinarily powerful. Each one of them is inspired by some aspect of camp life. My granddaughter right now actually is touring Dachau in Germany. And though it is not one of the most memorable of camps to visit, there is a sculpture 45 feet long made of iron, and it shows human beings intertangled kind of with barbed wire. And sometimes they are so thin that you can't even tell which is which except for the hands. It's very powerful. Maybe just look up, Google sometime, Memorials and Monuments of the Holocaust. They are simply beautiful, and you can't forget them. Next one is Manas Sperber. Sperber is a psychologist. He was born in Austria, but escaped to France when the Nazis came to power. He was a communist for a while, but he left the party when Stalin started his horrendous purges. I asked you to look at him because he makes an interesting point about forgetting. He says that the only way the Jews can ever forget the Holocaust is to know with absolute certainty that Germany will never forget it. Jews themselves have vowed to never forget. Yet this guy has a very interesting idea. It's both disturbing and practical. Sperber votes for forgiveness and reconciliation as a general rule because families, communities, and nations can't last long without it. We somehow know by instinct, he says, that our shared common humanity and destiny are even more important than justice. Even after the Holocaust, life must go on. He speaks of an old Jewish phrase, kulo chayev, meaning all are guilty, all bear responsibility. If thou shouldst mark iniquities, O Lord, who could stand? There is so much guilt buried under the grass of the death camps that just punishment would be too terrible. It would be infinite and endless, Sperber says, just as the sin was. The world would pass away. This reminds me of a postcard, and I meant to keep it, but I don't have it, or I meant to bring it, just a Xerox copy. One of my students, Panina Frankis, brought me a postcard from her grandmother. It was sent from the Warsaw ghetto to her great aunt when postcards were still allowed. The writing was weak and very small. Panina translated its two lines for me. The first, send bread, don't care how old. And the second, what the earth covers, one must forget. In that poor woman's position, she would die there. How could she bear to remember all the friends and relatives she had already lost to the deportations? If she remembered them, she would go mad. However, Hitler boasted that the Reich would last 1,000 years. We who are alive now have a moral obligation to not forget my student's grandmother and the millions like her, who died not by the millions, but one by one by one. We must remember the Reich for 1,000 years and then 10,000 more. Harry Wu. His is not the voice I want to end on, but he makes one very frightening point drawn from his years in China under Chairman Mao. He was imprisoned, tortured, and terrorized for 19 years in a slave labor camp for failing to show up for 3 so-called struggle sessions designed to ensure students' total conformity to Maoist ideals. But he says, a confession like Carl's would never happen in China because there was no understanding that what the communists did to their own people was in any way morally wrong. The society that the communists founded was designed to drain any remnants of humanity out of a person. To survive there, you had to give up your conscience. What would he say to Carl? That he was responsible for his actions, but that every soldier and compliant citizen and silent bystander in Germany and around the world shares that responsibility with him. And that includes Americans who turned away ships of Jewish refugees desperate for sanctuary. They made a movie about the St. Louis. I think it's called Voyage of the Damned, about FDR and the State Department feeling that it was too much of a security risk, send them back. Desmond Tutu. I don't even know if I agree with Tutu, but I love the dignity and practicality of his essay. That Simon could even consider forgiveness is mind-boggling to him, but by no means unique. He has met and talked to many people who have gone through hell in South Africa and elsewhere, yet who are, to his endless amazement, able to forgive. This magnanimity, this nobility of spirit, he writes, is quite breathtakingly unbelievable. I have often felt I should say, let us take off our shoes, because at this moment we are standing on holy ground. Yet, he acknowledges that such forgiveness is a costly business. Some can do it and some can't. But his model is Nelson Mandela, who after 27 years in prison, invited his white jailer to his inauguration as South Africa's first democratically elected president. All right, I would like to add one more and let a German have the last word. She is Dorothy Sowell, a theologian who taught at Union Theological Seminary in New York and in Germany until her death in 2003. On page 244, she writes about the day she heard a colleague of hers, a professor of German literature, had he not only been a Nazi, but had participated in the burning of books. Utterly shocked, she went to his apartment and privately confronted him. Was it true? Had he done this? Where did he stand now, she wanted to know, on the issue of burning books and people? And I will read what happened between the two of them. When I asked where he stood now, he wept. And then something utterly extraordinary happened, something I had never experienced before or since. He threw himself on the floor, knelt down, wrung his hands, and then folded them. I couldn't remain seated in my chair. I didn't want to leave, so I knelt beside him, and we prayed aloud the Lord's Prayer. Forgive us our sins. I had never known before what remorse was. Many years later, I learned what the word teshuvah meant in the Jewish tradition. Deliverance, changing one's ways, a new beginning. A Jewish tradition tells that teshuvah was created even before the creation, together with the Torah, the name of the Messiah, and other mysteries. Supposedly, there is no person, time, or place where teshuvah is not possible. Beautiful. Let me stop here for a moment. In contrast to that, all right, how much time? We have time. All right, I want to finish with the one lesson in forgiveness, God's mercy, that I have talked to my grandchildren about. This is the only one I ever got a good response from, my grandson Carter, who is a man of few words. A deep thinker, I think, but very, very private person. This is called The Parable of the Onion, and it is adapted from Dostoevsky's book, The Brothers Karamazov, which is my favorite book, I think, in the world, Russian. Once upon a time, there was a wicked peasant woman who grew old and died without leaving a single good deed behind. The devils caught her up and plunged her into the lake of fire. But her guardian angel stood by her and wondered, wasn't there one good deed of hers that he could remember and tell to God? And suddenly he had it. He flew up to God's throne and said, in winter, this old woman once pulled up an onion in her garden and gave it to a beggar woman at her gate. And God answered, you take that onion then, hold it out to her in the lake, and let her take hold and be pulled out. And if you can pull her out of the lake, let her come to paradise. But if the onion breaks, then the woman must stay where she is. The angel flew back to the woman and held out the onion to her. Come, he said, catch hold, and I'll pull you out Carefully, he began pulling her up, and the onion didn't break. But just as her feet cleared the lake of fire, other damned souls in the lake saw how she was being drawn out. They began to catch hold of her so as to be pulled out with her. Up they went, a chain of souls, and still the onion didn't break. But she was a very wicked woman. Full of resentment, she began kicking at the other souls. "I'm to be pulled out, not you," she said. "It's my onion, my good deed, not yours." As soon as she said that, the onion broke, and the wicked woman fell back into the lake, and she is burning there to this day. And the angel wept and went away. That actually penetrated Carter's little heart and soul. He said, yeah, I like that. So maybe remember it for your kids or grandkids. All right, folks, when you will have questions, but just to remind you, anyone can take a sunflower, maybe come down after worship or come out this way so they stay in water. And there are many packs of sunflower seeds here. Plant them if you have a sunny place in your yard, for Carl, even for Simon, for all of them. And these beautiful cookies, these are sunflower cookies. All right, does anyone want to start with a question or a comment about any of this? Yes.
You ought to, have you ever thought about publishing this?
No.
Doing a podcast? I mean, it's powerful.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
I mean,
I could possibly do that, but there are others who've written about the sunflower. It might be difficult.
Oh.
There's been so much response to it. Mine's just one. But I am going to make copies of it to send all my kids and grandkids, definitely, just to keep. If anybody wants a copy, I can bring a few in to share with someone else. Yes, the whole thing. I'll just make some copies of it. I could bring it in if anybody would like them. Okay, I will happy to do that. I'm doing it for my niece and nephew already anyway. Anything else? One thing, yes, go right ahead.
I think you started out with one of the questions was about Simon visiting the mother.
Yes.
And why he didn't lay into her and tell her what, and the reasons why he may or may not have. And I think basically what I would say to that is he knew as he went through the visit that it wouldn't have done himself any good either. It wouldn't have helped him heal anymore by doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And so delivering something to her that he might have wished he could say to Carl, it kind of gets in the way of, you know, he kind of did that as a side trip anyway. He was Simon was visiting someone else and then decided to go to Stuttgart. So in his mind, he was thinking, well, I may find her alive, I may find her dead.
Mm-hmm.
I think his feeling was, I wonder what was behind Carl. I wonder what was part of Carl's initially way of good turning into such a monster.
Yeah.
So I think that basically at that point, he probably thought it would just be too much.
Yes, for her to bear.
Both of them.
Mm-hmm.
Solved no problem.
Yeah, the people he wanted to reach. And actually that book that you lent me, can you want to hold it up there? Yeah, the man that wrote this, he was in concentration camps also, amazing. Wrote this book when he was 100 years old because it kind of took that long for people to convince him, you need to tell your story, and recognize that though it was good for him to be among other survivors because they could understand each other's emotions and the grief and the anger and all of that, But the audience you wanted to reach is the young, the ones who are just coming up and may still have the same kinds of temptations that Carl had to join up with something that seems so exciting and so powerful and kind of elevates his own status just to be a part of it. Yeah, that book, The Happiest Man on Earth, I think it was I finished it just last night, and it ends on such a positive note. His appreciation of life and every relationship he has. And when he speaks to kids in high school or whatever, he tells them, tell your parents every day how much you love them. Stop with the defiant, we're teenagers, we can do whatever we want business. Tell your parents you love them. What is really important are the things that are not faddish. Relationships and love and respect. Okay. Anything else? Yes.
Erstwhile, Christian boy brain could be manipulated, and all his mother went along with it. The father was totally horrified. But I have no idea, as I grew up steeped in the Christian church, would my mind be bent? Can it happen to own everybody, or do you, no matter who or what you are, to condemn Carl, it could be yourself. You must think that could happen.
Yes, absolutely right. It can happen to your kids, no matter how much love they have had and how many Sundays they've gone to church. Yes.
I thought that Carl's visit with the mother was self-centered on his part because of his tortured sense of how did I do with her son? You know, was I right? Was I wrong? Mm-hmm. So I thought that was kind of, I'm glad he didn't say anything to her, but I thought that was for himself, not for her. Mm-hmm. And I felt badly for Carl because as an 18, 16-year-old man, boy, attractiveness of being a Hitler youth must have been incredible to pull a boy from the church. Mm-hmm. And I mean, they had it all going. They had the uniforms, they had the songs, it was everything. And so I could see that happening. Mm-hmm. I could see it happening to me.
Sure.
You know, and I think anybody with an honest appraisal of themselves could be attracted to black and white, good and evil, simple answers for, simple solutions.
Or complicated problems.
Mm-hmm. As an 18-year-old boy, you are not looking for simple solutions. You are looking for fun. I don't think it was right of him to ask for forgiveness. Obviously, it's up to God to do that. Mm-hmm. But it was really good. Good read. Really a challenge.
Yes, it sure is. Let me say just one other thing about C.S. Lewis and Dante's idea that the gates of hell are locked from the inside. First of all, both of them are saying that hell actually exists. It's not so much a place with fire and brimstone and all that. It is a state of mind in which the corrupt and the perverse will experience torment and damnation without rest or reprieve, and they have no desire to change their minds, to get out of there. The inhabitants are there by their preference and their consent. It is not an angry, wrathful, and vengeful God who is getting back at them by throwing them into hell. It is a place of self exile. They can leave at any time. And this line particularly, it probably ought to be up there. Hell is not where they are, but what they are. Take any one of them out of hell and set them down in heaven, and they will start breeding discord, and their egotism will want to be the best in heaven. If you've read Paradise Lost, we used to teach it in schools. We don't teach it anymore, and it's such a masterpiece. It talks about basically what motivated Satan, or Lucifer as he was then, the angel of light, second in command, so to speak. What motivated him to think that somehow he could stage a rebellion and he can be God? And of course, he lost the battle, but he took a lot of angels with him, and they ended up in hell in the lake of fire, and he was still defiant. Others were saying, go back to heaven, crawl back to heaven on your knees if you have to. You don't have to stay here. And that's when he said, it's better to reign in hell than to serve in heaven. Yes.
I'm reminded of Dunn's Paradise Lost, and there are the lines, the mind is its own place. It can make a heaven of hell or a hell of heaven.
Wonderful. Yes. Surely the truth.
Yeah, there's a TV series on Peacock called The Tattooist of Auschwitz.
Is it a series?
Yes. And it is, especially in the first few episodes, it's an incredibly realistic depiction of what.
Can we get it on Fire Stick, do you think? Or is it on a TV station? Or?
Yeah, it's called Peacock. It's a streaming service of NBC.
Oh, the title is, again?
Tattooist of Auschwitz.
Okay.
It's a true story.
Okay.
Embedded in all this is a love story. It's really fascinating.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate it. Any other recommendations of books or movies? A lot of that. There's a book called The Tattooist of Auschwitz. It's probably based on that. Okay, wonderful.
It's one of the is it the Auschwitz lawyer? That the book is okay, but the background, the author was so careful to be sure that everything he wrote about the camps was true.
Mm-hmm.
And it really takes you into very personal things that happened to them, and things that you have a hard time understanding how a human being can do.
Yes,
this
to be so cool.
A human being can survive.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, it's worth reading as well.
Mm-hmm. And all of them are worth reading, not just to be aware of the terrible things that happened there, the inhumanity of man, but the heroic things, the amazing things. I just finished a book called The Violinist of Auschwitz, and it's based on history, what actually happened there. One of the SS in charge there had a son who, like Franz, he was rebellious. He despised the Nazi regime, but he was protected because his father was very high up in the SS. But he finally went too far, and they arrested him, and they brought him to Auschwitz, where his father served. And his father said, don't worry, you know, I'll get you a cushy place, you know, where you can live here and you get light duty and you'll be out in 6 months. And what he planned to do with his son was to get him into the Auschwitz Symphony Orchestra, which, again, seems like a contradiction in terms. You can't believe that could exist there, but it did. But the Auschwitz Symphony Orchestra already had a superb world-class pianist, Jewish, who was being saved because he was needed in that orchestra to help teach the other people the music. And he told his son, who was a mediocre pianist, we'll gas that guy and you can take his place. And the son said, no, you won't. I refuse. And the father said, yes, you will. Well, the son went into the music block and he met this pianist, Steinberg, I think was his last name. And he played for him. And he said it was like music from heaven. It was so beautiful. And so he picked up a hammer that he saw lying around put his hand up against the wall and smashed his own left hand so that he could not be the pianist and the really great, the masterful pianist would live. That is an example of radical goodness and self-sacrifice. It would be hard. You couldn't make it up, I guess. Yes, it's called The Violinist of Auschwitz. The violinist they're speaking of was Alma Rose, and she was the niece of Gustav Mahler, who wrote the Resurrection Symphony. All of it is full of irony.
I have a question.
Yes.
Jews and Christians believe in the same God, but they have totally opposite views on forgiveness. What do Jews and Christians need to do to overcome this problem? If God is in conflict with himself, that's impossible. So we are in conflict. How do we resolve that?
In a way, the Holocaust helped bring Christians and Jews closer eventually. At first, the Jews could not help but associate Nazism with the Lutheran Church and the Christian religion. So they were afraid, literally. If a priest or an archbishop or anything came into a camp, they were not welcomed. You know, or, please, will you talk to me? Tell me about God. Why won't he help us? Nowadays, at least, Jews and Christians don't really have such opposite views, I don't think. We have perhaps different ideas of the threshold of forgiveness, but the Jews have more to forgive, certainly, from us than we do from them. We have burned, by we, I mean Christianity, Christians have burned countless, 400, 500 synagogues. The Jews have never burned down one church. So in a sense, maybe we are the ones that need forgiveness the most. And I can understand that Jews get upset when Christians try to sort of hijack the Holocaust and say, you know, we were all in it together, everybody's guilty, we have to all forgive, and if not, forget. The Jewish people that I worked with in Classrooms Without Borders, there was really very little difference in how we viewed forgiveness. Can you explain what that difference is as you see it? Yeah.
153 respondents who read the Sunflower of the Jews, all of them said, you know, murder is the unforgivable sin. Mm-hmm. One can't be forgiven except by the people that you harmed, and all the Holocaust people are dead, so you can't be forgiven. The Christians said, well, Jesus taught us that if you are to be forgiven, you must forgive. And so the Christian writers were saying that there could be forgiveness. So there's a conflict. You either can or you can't do it. But it's the same God that each religion is, finding their answers from. And I don't think God's in conflict, but I think we are. So what do we do about that?
Talk to each other, I guess. Hold more, you know, Jewish Christian events together where we can discuss these things. But it's not as though every Jew thinks the same thing about forgiveness any more than all Christians believe exactly the same thing. The varieties or the theories of forgiveness, I guess, can vary considerably from person to person and what is forgivable and what isn't. I think what Jews resent, perhaps, especially those who are survivors, who are Christians, who didn't go through it, who didn't lose, 50 or 60 relatives and have their entire lives turned inside out. How can Christians presume to say what God will forgive with respect to that? And I think that Carl comes back to the idea of forgiveness. He was taught it, obviously, but he didn't come to it until he himself was hurt. And compared to what most Jews suffered in these camps, Carl had a cushy life, pretty much. at least when he was badly hurt, he was in a hospital. He had the best care that he could be given at the time. The Jews had nothing like that. So they really do have more to forgive, and they are wary of what Dietrich Bonhoeffer called cheap grace, willing to pass out forgiveness, you know, to just about anybody for anything, even though the crime was not even committed against you, or the crime committed against you is not 1% of what other people have suffered because of this same regime. So I understand the differences, and I guess I just accept them, but it's good to talk to each other about it. Anything else? It's actually quarter of, should we quit or one more? All right, folks, thank you so much for coming. This is not the funnest subject. Thank you. Thank you so much. And I will get some copies of this made. Do I?